Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the March 11th, 2022 issue of the Week Magazine. The cover is usually a drawing, often kind of cartoon fashion, but we have this week a photograph. I've seen one or two like that since I've been reading it. The scene is a street scene in Ukraine. It actually looks like a road leading into a town. There is a banner across the road. I think it's in Ukrainian. It's torn in half. And in the foreground, off to the side of the road, is a completely destroyed Russian tank. It's demolished and still smoking. The headline is Defiance. Ukrainians fight for their freedom as Putin escalates his onslaught. And that is our first main story. We'll start right there. Russia escalates its war on a valiant Ukraine. What happened? The Russian army rained rockets, missiles, and shells on cities across Ukraine this week, escalating an invasion that has met condemnation from around the world and unexpectedly effective resistance from Ukrainian forces. A week into the campaign, Russian President Vladimir Putin was reportedly deeply frustrated that Kyiv and other major cities had not fallen to an assault involving more than 100,000 Russian troops and thousands of tanks and armored vehicles. In response to the fierce Ukrainian resistance, Russia changed tactics, encircling and laying siege to Kyiv, Kharkiv, Kherson, and Mariupol, and bombarding civilian areas, government buildings, and critical infrastructure. In Kharkiv, Ukraine's second-largest city, residential neighborhoods were under intensifying fire that was killing and maiming innocent citizens, said Mayor Igor Terekhov. Ukraine said that more than 2,000 civilians had been killed. But Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky claimed that 6,000 Russian soldiers had been killed, and there were widespread reports of low morale, desertion, and surrenders among Russian soldiers. Ukrainians rallied behind Zelensky, who rose to the status of folk hero by turning down an offer from the U.S. to evacuate him. The fight is here, Zelensky said. I don't need a ride. I need ammunition. Russia faced near blanket condemnation from around the world and punishing economic sanctions from Western nations that left his economy reeling. The U.S., European Union, and Canada banned Russian planes from their airspace. Switzerland broke its tradition of neutrality to join sanctions against Russia. And in an about-face, Germany joined nearly two dozen other countries, including formerly neutral Sweden and Finland, in sending arms. Nearly 900,000 refugees fled Ukraine, clogging border crossings with Poland and Moldova. The UN Refugee Agency predicted the total will reach 4 million. In Kyiv, residents packed into basement shelters and subway stations as thousands of citizens took up arms to defend the city, assembling Molotov cocktails and bolstering army forces that dug trenches, built barricades, and braced for an assault. Being a Ukrainian right now is to fight, said Rostislav Zavhorodny, a painter and art tutor. It's better to die than become part of Russia. What the editorial said. Putin's Ukraine invasion isn't going according to his script, said the Wall Street Journal. He'd planned on rolling into Kyiv, killing Zelensky or chasing him into exile, and setting up a puppet government. But he underestimated the tenacity of Ukrainians. Their resistance has inspired the world, and we must support them every way we can, not just for their sake, but for ours. Putin wants a new world disorder, and if he succeeds in Ukraine, breaking NATO will be his next ambition. Putin's aggression has set off a geopolitical earthquake, said the Boston Globe. Formerly neutral nations like Sweden have offered armed support and united around unheard-of sanctions. President Biden has shown strong leadership in rallying NATO and holding the alliance together. But the true hero is Zelensky, whose courage and defiance have inspired the world to stand against Putin and for the democratic freedoms too many in the West have taken for granted. What the columnist said: Putin has vastly underestimated and misunderstood Ukrainians, said Zoya Sheftalovich in Politico. Isolated and delusional, he thought his troops would be welcomed by Russian-speaking Ukrainians, as nostalgic for the Soviet heyday as he is. But all Ukrainians know what he offers is oppression, murder, and gangsterism. And in Zelensky, they found an inspiring leader. As these brave patriots dig in for an extended bloody siege, Putin faces a daunting question. How do you occupy and control 44 million Ukrainians who suddenly have something to believe in? Zelensky is more than just a man now, said Matt Lewis in The Daily Beast. The diminutive former comedian has emerged as a towering symbol of defiance, displaying the kind of moral and physical courage that inspires people to be their bravest selves. And for a country of underdogs, hope can be as powerful as deadly weapons, and courage is contagious. Zelensky may be a hero worthy of Hollywood, but this is not a movie, said David French in The Atlantic, and there's no script that gives the underdog victory in the end. Despite many setbacks, the Russian army still has overwhelming firepower. If the Russians take control of Kyiv, or kill or capture Zelensky, hope will give way to despair, and true independence will once again be a distant dream. Putin may eventually win this battle, but his larger war is already lost, said Corey Sheikh, also in The Atlantic. He wanted to crush Ukraine's democratic dreams while demonstrating NATO's fecklessness and dividing the West. Instead, he's done the opposite. Ukrainians have made clear they'll never submit to his rule, and free societies inspired by their pluck and bravery have united to resist Putin's evil. The Russian dictator set out to destroy the liberal international order. Instead, he's proved the architect of its revitalization. Controversy of the week: Putin's nuclear threats. Is he just bluffing? Could Putin go nuclear? Asked Eric Levitz in New York Magazine. The idea that even a paranoid homicidal dictator like Vladimir Putin would launch an unprovoked nuclear strike seemed unthinkable until last week. As Russia began its invasion of Ukraine, Putin bragged about his country's nuclear arsenal and new hypersonic missiles, and warned that any nation that tries to stand in our way would suffer consequences you have never seen in your entire history. He said he was putting his nation's nuclear forces on special combat readiness. Most Russian military analysts think Putin is bluffing to ensure that NATO doesn't get involved in the war. But given the scale of devastation that a nuclear conflagration would entail, Putin's threats are causing alarm in both Europe and the U.S. If the war continues to go badly for Russia, its economy collapses, and Putin faces a possible coup, what kind of violence might a homicidal dictator embrace? Putin is playing an insanely dangerous game here, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. That's why the Biden administration wisely did not raise the U.S.'s own nuclear alert status. Threats could escalate in an eye blink, and with the U.S. and Russia having more than 4,500 nuclear missiles each in their arsenals, an accident or mistake could result in a nuclear exchange that would devastate humanity. Fear of a nuclear Armageddon is familiar to Americans who remember the Cold War, said Nicholas Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times. For decades, the prospect of mushroom clouds rising in our cities was a hair trigger away, hanging on a single miscalculation, a hot-headed leader, a press of a few buttons. Surely Putin knows he would ensure Russia's annihilation if he pushed his button. But what are we to make of reports that he's become unbalanced and unrealistic during 2 years of pandemic isolation? He doesn't sound or act like an ideal partner for a game of nuclear chicken. This is why it would be insane for the U.S. or NATO forces to establish a no-fly zone in Ukraine or cross the border to engage Russia's military. Imposing economic devastation on Russia, however justified it may be, also poses a risk, said Jim Garrity in National Review. In addition to its arsenal of ICBMs and submarine missiles, Russia has an estimated 2,000 smaller tactical nukes designed for battlefield use. Even the smallest nuke, of course, releases deadly radiation that makes the blast area uninhabitable for decades. But we must worry that if Putin fails to annex Ukraine through conventional warfare, he's mad enough to decide that his best option is to nuke parts of it into oblivion. The U.S. and NATO must ensure it never comes to that, said James Acton in the Washington Post. Even as the West helps Ukraine fight off the invasion, it must avoid making Putin feel so humiliated and desperate he could do something catastrophic. If the conflict drags on, eventually Ukraine, the U.S., and its NATO allies will have to try to create an off-ramp for Putin that allows him to call off the bloodshed while saving face. Options include lifting sanctions and recognizing Crimea as part of Russia in return for a Russian withdrawal. Yes, it is deeply distasteful to identify incentives for Putin to back down after he launched an illegal war that will probably kill thousands of Ukrainians, but agonizing compromise is preferable to nuclear war. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for payback after a Ukrainian mechanic opened valves and partially sank the $7.7 million luxury superyacht owned by his boss, Alexander McKee, the CEO of a Russian weapons company. My boss is a criminal who sells weapons that kill the Ukrainian people, Taras Ostapchuk, 55, told police in Majorca, Spain. After being arrested and released, he left to fight in Ukraine. It was a good week for gay men who academically outperformed straight men and all other groups in high school and college, according to a new Notre Dame study. And it was a good week for the lazy, after a new study found that sedentary people could boost their bicep strength by 12% by doing 3 seconds of resistance exercise a day. But it was a bad week for smugglers after border officers in Southern California seized 1,336 pounds of methamphetamine disguised as onions. A sniffer dog alerted officials that the carefully wrapped small white globes weren't actually onions. It's a bad week for the moon, which was expected to be hit Friday by 3 tons of space junk traveling at 5,800 miles per hour. The junk, possibly part of a Chinese rocket from a 2014 moon mission, will gouge a large new crater on the dark side. And it was a bad week for freedom fighters after about a dozen people showed up at a trucker rally against vaccine mandates in Washington, D.C. Where are the trucks? Asked organizer Kyle Sefcik. In other news, a short piece here. Justices consider EPA's emissions authority. In a case with major implications for climate change, the Supreme Court heard arguments this week over whether the Environmental Protection Agency can regulate carbon emissions from U.S. power plants without specific authority from Congress. Some of the conservative justices appeared skeptical that the Clean Air Act gives the EPA broad authority over regulating emissions across the power sector. The court has grown more conservative since 2016, when it stopped the Obama administration from forcing power plants to drastically reduce their carbon output. Should this court side with the 19 mostly GOP-led states and coal companies suing the EPA, it would deal a major blow to the Biden administration's climate goals. Briefing this week, also dealing with the Ukrainian war. Ukraine's long quest for independence. Vladimir Putin says Ukraine has always been part of Russia. What's the real history? What is Putin's claim? The Russian president insists that there is no separate Ukrainian nation. Ukrainians and Russians are one people, he declared last year in a 7,000-word diatribe to support his case. Yet Ukrainians have their own language, culture, and history, much of it a litany of Russian oppression. There has been a strong impulse of Ukrainian nationalism for at least the last century, said historian David Patrikarikos, with the Russians just slapping them down militarily. It's true that both nations trace their roots back to the first East Slavic state, Kievan Rus, which stretched from the Baltic to the Black Sea and lasted from the 9th to the mid-13th century. That medieval empire was founded by the Vikings. Rus, Rus, is the Slavic word for a red-haired Scandinavian who swept down from the north, conquered and intermarried with local Slavic tribes, and established their capital at Kiev. Russians see the region surrounding Kiev as the font of their culture and religion. Vladimir the Great converted it to Orthodox Christianity in 988, laying the foundation of the Russian Church. But in the 13th century, Kiev was devastated by Mongol invaders, and power shifted north to a small Rus trading post outpost called Moscow. What happened to Ukraine? Its territory was carved up by competing powers. Poland and Lithuania dominated it for hundreds of years, but by the end of the 18th century, the Austro-Hungarian Empire had taken some of the West and the Russians had grabbed the rest, including the Donbas region. This is when Ukrainian identity grew in earnest. And in 1862, the Ukrainian poet Pavlo Chubinsky wrote, "Ukraine has not yet perished," the song that is now the national anthem. The Tsars, though, referred to their new territory as Little Russia and tried to crush the surge of Ukrainian nationalism, banning the speaking of Ukrainian in schools. After World War I, following the collapse of the Russian and Habsburg empires, Ukraine enjoyed a spell of independence, but by 1921, the Red Army had reconquered most of it. What was Soviet rule like? Ukraine suffered enormously under the Soviet boot. It was the largest Soviet socialist republic after Russia and vitally important thanks to its fertile farmlands and key Black Sea ports. But Stalin's brutal rule devastated Ukraine. His forced collectivization of farming brought a famine in 1932 and 33, and up to 7 million Ukrainians died, mostly in the country's east. Ukrainians called that tragedy the Holodomor, meaning extermination by hunger. Stalin later repopulated the east and the adjoining Crimean Peninsula with Russians. When did independence come? In 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed, freeing its many republics to choose their own identity. In a referendum, 92% of Ukrainians voted for their independence. For many Russians, the separation from Slavic Ukraine and Belarus was traumatic, in a way that the loss of Baltic and Central Asian republics was not. And Putin never accepted it. He's always been determined to keep Ukraine out of the European Union and NATO, and he has used Ukraine's dependence on Russian natural gas as a weapon. cutting off supplies in 2006 as Ukrainians froze in the winter cold. In its first decades of independence, Ukraine was divided between Ukrainian speakers in the West, who wanted to align their country with Europe, and Russian speakers who looked to Moscow. Russia tried to exploit this divide and continued to interfere in Ukrainian politics. How did Russia interfere? Ukraine's 2004 election was a showdown between pro-Western Viktor Yushchenko and pro-Russian Viktor Yanukovych. During the campaign, Yushchenko was disfigured when he ate food poisoned with dioxin, an act widely attributed to Russia. After the vote was rigged for Yanukovych, Ukrainians rose up in the Orange Revolution, which culminated in a revote and a victory for Yushchenko. In the 2010 election, though, Russia meddled again with the help of American political consultant Paul Manafort, who would later go on to chair Donald Trump's 2016 campaign, and Yanukovych regained the presidency. Under Russian pressure, Yanukovych canceled a trade deal that would have brought Ukraine closer to the EU, leading to another uprising that forced him out in 2014, the Maidan Revolution, or Revolution of Dignity. Enraged, Putin promptly annexed Crimea and sent covert troops into Ukraine's east to start a separatist war. How has the war expanded? The war in the east has simmered for years, killing more than 14,000 people. Donetsk and Luhansk declared themselves independent republics, a break that Putin recognized last week, just ahead of his massive invasion of Ukraine. Putin's fantastical thesis, backed by false Russian propaganda, is that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is a Western puppet heading a neo-Nazi regime that has engaged in a genocide of Russians within Ukraine. Zelensky, who's Jewish and a Russian speaker, countered last week with a direct appeal to the Russian people. "You are told that this blaze will bring freedom to the people of Ukraine," he said. "But the people of Ukraine are already free." Time for a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. Start with Why China is Watching Ukraine. How will the war in Ukraine affect Chinese thinking about Taiwan? Asked Andrew Sullivan. You can be sure that Xi Jinping will be watching closely how the West reacts to Russia's invasion and how long Ukraine can fend off a much mightier military. Parallels between China-Taiwan and Russia-Ukraine are as striking as they are unnerving. China sees Taiwan as part of its national identity, the same way Vladimir Putin and other Russian nationalists see Ukraine as part of theirs. Taiwan and Ukraine have forged independent democratic nations in the shadow of giant autocracies next door, which see them as rogue, breakaway regions within their own sphere of influence. For Xi and Putin, the fact that these defiant democracies are so closely allied with their rivals in the West is intolerable. It is hard for outsiders to truly understand the historical grievance and resentment that emboldened nationalists in Russia and China feel toward the West. But make no mistake, China will always care much more about Taiwan than we do. Xi knows the U.S. is committed to the defense of Taiwan, the way we have committed to the defense of Ukraine. Kinda, but not really. At some point, Xi may call our bluff. Anti-vaxxers will be like smokers. As this wave of the pandemic ebbs, said Benjamin Mazur, lots of people are saying that COVID is or will soon be like the flu. But while COVID, like the flu, is a respiratory illness that may rise and fall with the seasons, Its future role in our society can best be compared to cigarette smoking. COVID vaccines have proven to be among the safest and most effective therapies in all of modern medicine, with three doses virtually eliminating the risk of serious illness and death for most people. Flu shots are significantly less effective, and the flu is far less deadly. Not getting vaccinated against COVID is a self-destructive choice, and so is smoking, which kills more than 400,000 people each year. Smokers are up to 30 times more likely to develop lung cancer than non-smokers. Similarly, the unvaccinated are 51 times more likely to die of COVID than those who've been boosted. Only about 14% of Americans still smoke, thanks to public education efforts and bans on indoor smoking. But it's not politically feasible to ban smoking altogether, so it still kills 400,000 Americans a year. That may be the future of COVID. This column comes from the UK. We knew Russian money was dirty. Britain's belated crackdown on Russia's oligarchs' money should have come a decade ago, said Matthew Said. Arguably, we've always known that the tycoons who stashed their billions in British real estate, sports teams, and investment funds were little more than criminals. But their corruption became public record in 2011 during a lawsuit between Boris Berezovsky, now deceased, and Roman Abramovich, who both lived in the UK. We learned that in the 1990s, these men and others helped themselves to Russia's oil and mineral wealth at a fraction of its true price in exchange for propping up Boris Yeltsin as Russian president. The result was that the oligarchs emerged with the riches of Croesus, and Yeltsin's successor, Vladimir Putin, inherited a state operating as a fully fledged kleptocracy. The Americans always berated us for our addiction to Russian money, which made a mockery of sanctions against Putin, and we knew deep down that by accepting it, we were giving a green light to Putin's mafia to plunder more wealth from Russian people. The British government has now announced its own sanctions and claims it will cleanse our financial districts of their oligarch taint. Let's hope it means business so we can end this sordid chapter in our history. Last word, our feature article, titled this week, A Billionaire Does the Math. Leon Cooperman spends 17 hours a day making money that he plans to give away, said Eli Saslow in the Washington Post. He's sure that young people can still get ahead if they have a work ethic like his. The stock market had been open for only 17 minutes when Leon Cooperman picked up the phone to check how much money he'd made. He dialed a private line from Boca Raton, Florida, to his trading desk in New Jersey, just as he did a dozen times a day. "Decent start this morning?" he asked. "Oh, yeah. The market's shaky, but you're up. Give me the numbers. Looks like $6-7 million. "Fine, thank you. Let's keep holding steady," said Cooperman, 78. He hung up and watched the stock graph on his computer screen as it rose from 1 minute to the next, charting another good day to be a billionaire in America. Outside the office, he could see his wife leaving to play in her weekly bridge game and a group of golfers strolling past on a private course. He'd chosen to live in Florida for at least 183 days each year, in part to benefit from the state's low tax rate for residents. And from 7 a.m. until midnight, he was typically seated at the desk in his office, managing the more than $2.5 billion he'd made during a career as an investor and hedge fund manager. "I don't want to say it's all play money at this point, But what else could I possibly spend it on? He sometimes wondered. His wife's walk-in closet was already bigger than the South Bronx apartment where he'd grown up. Their Florida home had a custom-built infinity pool, and in 5 years, he'd never once gone in for a swim. The cumulative wealth of America's 745 billionaires has grown by an estimated 70% since the beginning of the pandemic. Together, those 745 billionaires are now worth more than the bottom 60% of American households combined. And each day, Cooperman could see the gap widening on his balance sheet. Up an average of $4,788 per minute in the stock market, $1.9 million per day, and $700 million total in 2021. Cooperman knew what people imagined when they thought of billionaire. He'd read the stories of excess and extravagance and witnessed some of it firsthand. But that wasn't him. He didn't spend $238 million on a New York penthouse like hedge fund manager Ken Griffin, or vacation at his own private island in Belize like Bill Gates, or throw himself $10 million birthday parties featuring camels and acrobats like investor Steven Schwarzman. He didn't have his own spaceships like Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, or a 600-foot flying airship like Sergey Brin, or a decommissioned Soviet fighter jet like Larry Ellison, or a $215 million yacht with a helipad and a pool like Steve Wynn, or a private train with three staterooms like John Paul DeJoria, or a $5 million luxury car or collection like Kylie Jenner. What Cooperman had for transportation was a 25-year-old Schwinn bicycle he liked to ride around the neighborhood and a Hyundai he used for running errands a few times a week. He rechecked the stock graph on his screen and picked up his phone to call his wife of 57 years, Toby, who was sitting in her office suite down the hall. "I'm going to head out and grab some of those Costco lamb chops later," he told her. They'd been together since they met at Hunter College in 1962, when tuition at the public New York University cost as little as $24 per semester, and the promise of a life in America was that each generation would surpass the one before. More than 90% of children born in the United States during the 1940s would go on to out-earn their parents. Toby was the daughter of a struggling pillowcase salesman from Romania. He was the son of a plumber's apprentice who immigrated from Poland at age 13, never finished high school, worked 6 days a week, and later died of a heart attack while carrying a sink up the stairs to a fourth-story apartment. Cooperman waited tables during the summers, worked for Xerox while he went to business school at night, and then started as an analyst at Goldman Sachs, making $12,500 a year. "My Ph.D. is for poor, hungry, and driven," he'd like to say. Within 9 years, he'd been named a partner. Within a decade, he was a millionaire. Together, he and Toby had learned how to be rich, which mostly meant deciding how not to spend their money. He still felt most comfortable shopping for clothes wholesale and commuting to work on New Jersey public transit. Toby enjoyed her job as a special education teacher, even if she didn't need the $25 an hour, so she continued working and donated her salary back to the school. The Coopermans gave away $150 million to a hospital in New Jersey, $50 million for college scholarships to Newark high school students, $40 million to Columbia Business School, $40 million to Hunter College, $30 million to Performing Arts, $25 million to the Jewish Family Fund, $20 million to skilled nursing, $15 million to food banks, and on it went. But no matter how much they gave away, their money continued to make more money. In the past 50 years, the gap between poor families and the top 0.1% had increased more than tenfold. Children now had only a 43% chance of out-earning their parents. "Mr. Cooperman, your donation is needed to keep the American dream off life support," read one of the dozens of solicitations he received each day. "Mr. Cooperman, the pandemic has left 60 million families at risk of losing their homes." He donated to more than 50 organizations each year and also to a number of people who wrote him in personal distress. Other than my family, writing checks is the most meaningful thing I do, Cooperman said. And yet, no matter how many zeros he included, it left him wanting to do more. He who dies rich dies disgraced, read a quotation attributed to Andrew Carnegie on Cooperman's office desk. But on this day, he was still rich and getting richer. What's enough, he wondered. What's the answer? He checked the stock graph on his screen, up $2.6 million in the past 5 hours. Each day when the stock market closed at 4 p.m., he checked the final numbers on his 40 stock holdings, reviewed his investment strategy for the next day, and then left for a two-mile walk around the palm trees and putting greens of St. Andrew's Country Club in Boca Raton. The community was set off from the surrounding suburbs by a canal, a gatehouse, a 10-foot wall, and an infrared security system. He and Toby had spent almost all of their time during the pandemic within the gates of St. Andrew's, eating dinner outside at the clubhouse and playing cards with friends. But every few days, they liked to go for a drive. Once, early in the pandemic, they'd driven to a quiet nearby park, only to find more than 150 cars lined up in the parking lot as people waited for bags of canned goods at an impromptu food bank. Depressing and staggering in a country of such wealth, Cooperman said, and it made him remember a poem, 7 Miles, that his granddaughter wrote and published when she was in middle school, about the physical proximity between the extreme wealth of Short Hills, New Jersey, where Cooperman had his other home, and the extreme poverty in nearby Newark. At one end, we have too much, she'd written. At the other, they have nothing. Spread it all, just 7 miles. She'd gone on to graduate Phi Beta Kappa from Stanford, becoming an ultra-liberal socialist type in favor of wealth redistribution, Cooperman said. He adored her and admired both her empathy and her intellect, but he'd repeatedly fought against the liberal idea that one way to redistribute that wealth was to tax billionaires at a rate of 70% or more. He told politicians in his letters that he was willing to pay more, but he believed the highest effective tax rate should be no more than 50%. What made America great is our system of capitalism, incentivizing work and effort and ingenuity, he'd written. Capitalism has flaws, but socialism has no benefits. Why not spread my work ethic instead of just my wealth? Now he looped around a cul-de-sac and turned back toward his house. For years he'd been doing these daily walks with his brother, Howard, until he died in December at age 85. And lately Cooperman has been thinking back over their lives. Cooperman had chosen to wake up at 5:15 each morning and devote 80 hours every week to his work, taking off only the Friday after Thanksgiving. His brother, meanwhile, had chosen not to go to college and then retired as soon as he could. He preferred to play racquetball, go to the casino with friends, and volunteer as a wheelchair transporter at the hospital. Cooperman had ended up with his billions and his name on the top of the hospital entrance. His brother had died with relatively modest amounts of money, but with a cell phone loaded with numbers for dozens of close friends. We both got what we worked for, Cooperman said. We were best friends, and we admired what each other had, but it would have been wrong to take what I earned and give it all over to him. He walked up his circular driveway into his house and back toward his office. Different choices, different outcomes, he said. The world isn't meant to be totally even. His choice. 12 more hours anchored to the chair in his office, monitoring the market and calling into his trading desk again and again as the sun reflected off the swimming pool outside his window. The market fell, the market rose. He bought $3 million in distressed bonds. He gave away another $5 million to a charity. He was $18 million up for the day. He was $6 million down. He was beating the market again by mid-morning, losing at lunch, winning an hour later, and then losing again. Does it make any sense, he asked himself. watching the numbers change on his screen. To sit inside all day in front of a machine, making money I don't need so I can give it to someone I don't know? He'd been wondering since his brother's death whether there was better ways to spend some of his time. So one afternoon before the stock market closed, he shut off his computer and drove a few miles outside of the gates of St. Andrews to visit Florida Atlantic University. The school's president had invited Cooperman to speak to a group of low-income college students about his career and values. The 40 or so students from a university scholarship program all came from families with incomes of $30,000 or less. They had been living on campus during the pandemic as some of their families were upended by layoffs, evictions, by a Haitian earthquake, a Dominican drought, by coronavirus infections, and COVID-19 deaths. I can understand some of the challenges you're facing right now, Cooperman said, starting a short PowerPoint presentation about his journey from a one-bedroom apartment to the Forbes 400 list of wealthiest Americans. I worked very hard. I wanted to win, he told them as he flipped to the next slide. I'm a great believer in capitalism, he said. We have the best economic system in the world. He finished going through the slides and then asked for questions, and after a while, a student in the center of the room raised her hand and waited for the microphone. She said she was also interested in a career in business, and she explained that one of the many barriers in her way was the startup cost. In Florida, you need $200, she said. You're going to need a lot more than that, Cooperman said. I know, she said. I just mean $200 to get the license, the paperwork, from zero. Cooperman looked at her for a moment and tried to imagine what it would mean to start again from zero, and what it would mean and what it would be like to ascend from poverty to extreme wealth, not in the 1960s, but in 2022, when that gap had multiplied 10 times. I'll admit, it's very hard, he said. It's gotten harder. But the 99% can still join the 1%. It's possible with enough luck and commitment. He told them about how he'd gotten up each morning at 5:15, how he'd chosen a job that he loved, how he'd gotten his PhD in being poor, hungry, and driven, how he'd followed his instincts, how he'd attacked each day like a lion chasing a gazelle as he raced to the pinnacle of the economy, and the 99% receded behind him. I could speak to the issues of both being rich and being poor, he told them. And as a billionaire in the bifurcating American economy, there was one truth of which he felt certain. Being rich is better, he said. A version of this story originally appeared in the Washington Post. We have a couple of short health and science pieces. Huge wildfires to become more frequent. The world is facing a global wildfire crisis that will see the number of fires explode in the coming years, a United Nations report warns. Commissioned after a series of deadly blazes from Portugal to the U.S. to Australia, the report concludes that climate change will raise the risk of devastating fires by as much as 57% by 2100. As soaring heat transforms wooded landscapes into tinderboxes. Even deep cuts to greenhouse gas emissions won't reverse the warming of the century, reports the Washington Post. Fires have already grown more extreme in regions with histories of annual burns, such as California, which saw a record 4 million acres go up in 2020. But they are also flaring in places unused to them, like Russia and Tibet. A few regions will be spared. Sub-Saharan Africa is seeing less fire because drought has killed off the grass that acts as fuel. But elsewhere, the risk will increase dramatically, and the report urges governments to overhaul their fire management approach. Most current public spending is skewed toward battling fires, not preventing them. The U.S. alone devotes 60% of its fire budget to firefighting. The UN's recommended strategy is to reduce the vegetation available to burn through thinning, grazing, and control burns. We're spending an enormous amount of money on suppression, said Peter Moore, a fire consultant with the UN. The solution, that solution, has run its course. Hearing aids lower dementia risk. Wearing a hearing aid may cut your risk of developing dementia. Researchers from the universities of Oxford and Ulster in the UK looked at data from more than 4,300 American adults with an average age of 68. People with untreated hearing loss were more than twice as likely as those without to develop mild cognitive impairment, MCI, a precursor to dementia. But there was no significant difference in risk between those with normal hearing and those who used hearing aids. This implies that use of hearing aids may help mitigate cognitive decline associated with hearing loss, the authors write, offering an actionable strategy to reduce the incidence of MCI. Previous studies have shown a link between hearing impairment and dementia risk, perhaps because deafness can make people socially isolated. But another possible reason for the difference is that among those with impairment, the ones who use hearing aids tend to be more affluent and have healthier lifestyles than the ones who do not. Nearly 25% of Americans aged 65 to 74 and 50% of those 75 and older have disabling hearing loss. And we'll flip over to the Talking Points page. We'll start with an article titled Jackson, How She Could Affect the Supreme Court. President Biden's new Supreme Court nomination gives us a renewed glimpse of the American promise, said Theodore Johnson in the Bulwark. Making good on his campaign promise, Biden has nominated a black woman to the highest court in the land. Federal Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, not only is a member of one of the country's longest disenfranchised groups, she also has an impeccable resume that immediately diffused Republican muttering that Biden would make an affirmative action nomination. A Harvard Law graduate, Jackson clerked for retiring Justice Stephen Breyer and has spent 9 years as a federal court judge, more than most of the court's sitting justices when they were nominated. Unlike many of those justices, Jackson has served in the trenches of the criminal justice system, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. She would be the first justice to have served as a federal public defender and the first with extensive criminal defense experience since Thurgood Marshall. Her courtroom work and her time as vice chair of the U.S. Sentencing Commission would bring a fresh perspective on how the criminal justice system affects society's least powerful to a court too often removed from real life. In a less polarized age, Jackson would be a shoo-in, said Ian Millhiser in Vox. Republican Senators Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins, and Lindsey Graham joined their Democratic colleagues last June in confirming her to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. Because of the nature of D.C. federal courts, her record is heavy on complex technocratic cases and light on political hot potatoes. There have been a handful, though, including the Trump administration's attempt to claim that White House counsel Don McGahn had absolute immunity from congressional testimony. She rejected that notion in a lengthy opinion that included the memorable declaration, "Presidents are not kings." My fellow conservatives don't question her qualifications, said Quinn Hillier in the Washington Examiner. But we do see worrisome evidence in Jackson's judicial record that she clumsily tries to use strained interpretations of the law to justify doctrinaire liberal political positions. She's been consistently anti-Trump, pro-union, and pro-criminal defendant, and has a striking record of reversals by higher courts. Republicans should oppose Jackson as a matter of principle, said Kevin Williamson in National Review. The rule of law depends on judges following the law as it is written, and liberal justices routinely fail to meet that standard. Jackson's record puts her to the left of fellow SCOTUS shortlister J. Michelle Childs A South Carolina federal district judge whom Representative Jim Clyburn and Graham both endorsed. Her record shows that she would almost certainly allow her personal sense of fairness to override the Constitution, and that should be disqualifying. Still, the Senate's minority party should be realistic, said Dan McLaughlin, also in National Review. Because judicial nominees have only needed to meet a 51-vote threshold since 2017, the Senate's 50 Democrats plus tiebreaker Vice President Kamala Harris virtually guarantee her confirmation. However they vote, all Republicans should treat Jackson with dignity and respect and thwart the Democrats' prefabricated narrative about conservatives disrespecting a black woman. Jackson's nomination may be barrier-breaking, said Harry Littman in the Los Angeles Times, but it's also the least consequential in 50 years. Replacing Breyer would still give the court only three liberal justices who cannot possibly break the conservative hammerlock of the six judges appointed by Republican presidents. That supermajority has wasted no time in flexing its muscle, said Kimberly Atkins Store in the Boston Globe. By the end of this term in June, those far-right judicial activists may make precedent-shattering rulings on abortion, affirmative action, and gun control. In this court, Jackson's primary job will be as a dissenter, a fiery opinion objecting to decisions that will disproportionately affect women and minorities. Might not change much now, but it could inspire political action and cement her as a voice for the ages. Jackson will make the Supreme Court better reflect the diversity of the nation, said the New York Times. Her voice can convey not only to her fellow justices, but also to the American people, how far out of sync the court is with the country. As a result of the overt partisanship in its rulings, the court has seen its public approval rating sink to 40%. If Americans lose faith that justices are doing their best to remain fair and impartial, the court's legitimacy is destroyed. Jackson's ascent should be celebrated. But for the immediate future, progress toward a fairer America will be won outside the court, not within it. Masks. Going, going, gone. For now. The CDC has made sweeping changes to its masking recommendations that allow most people to ditch their face coverings, said Spencer Kimball in CNBC.com. The new guidelines, which go into effect immediately, use rates of severe illness and hospitalization rather than infections as the key metric in a community, with counties rated green, yellow, or red. In green counties, where the COVID risk is low, masks aren't needed in schools or indoor places like restaurants or offices. In yellow counties, the risk is medium, and high-risk individuals are advised to consult their doctors about masking up. In red counties, cases remain high or are surging, and masks are advised. That puts only about 28% of Americans in locales where masks currently should be worn, down from 99% under the previous guidelines. The reason for the change, said CDC Director Rochelle Walensky, is simple. After a year of vaccination and multiple waves of COVID, roughly 90% of Americans have some immunity, and new cases have plunged 91% since the high on January 15th. It's still too soon to share our air, said Lawrence Gostin and Dr. Sable Kaseya in the Daily Beast. The day before the CDC announcement, there were still more than 73,000 new infections, 2,900 deaths, and 11,000 COVID patients in intensive care. Our vaccination rate is about 68%, far below peer nations, and effective treatments such as monoclonal antibodies and oral antiviral medications remain in short supply. So it makes no scientific sense to abandon life-saving masks until COVID cases drop further and stay low. Masks, however, have become increasingly unpopular, so the CDC is bowing to political pressure. I'd say the CDC finally got it right, said Dr. Lena Nguyen in the Washington Post. The new guidelines are a recognition that widespread immunity in Omicron have rendered COVID far less severe. And the new color-coded system establishes mitigation measures like masking as a dial rather than an on-off switch in case future variants and surges require a return to masking. The CDC is just playing catch-up, said Tim Carney in the Washington Examiner. Every state except Hawaii has already announced plans to end indoor mask mandates, and President Biden wanted to take credit for a shift that was happening with or without him. The CDC finally read the room. A couple of short notes. More than 5 million children around the globe lost a parent or direct caregiver during the first 20 months of the pandemic, according to a new study published by the medical journal The Lancet. After the Omicron surge, researchers estimated that number grew to 6.7 million. The British Ministry of Defense released footage of a Russian mobile crematorium and said Russia had brought it to Ukraine to incinerate evidence of their own casualties. It's a very chilling side effect of how the Russians view their forces, said British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace. And we'll finish with a quote from Malcolm Forbes, quoted in The Economist, who says, "Being right half the time beats being half right all the time." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.